This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Hi, welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. Thank you.
And I'm Jay Iyer.
Thanks so much. We are here, Jay, 100 episodes live.
I know, we've never done something like this. 100 episodes, we made it through. First off, before we've had a lot of help in putting this great show together. Over the past 100 episodes, our great producers, Don Gerasi, Sophie Mall, Ernie Manous, Edel Howland, the list is long.
Yes, yes.
People who've been here, Victoria Cordova, all these folks who've helped and put it together over the last 100 episodes. We are here at the finest coffee shop in the land, Brandon.
Yes.
We are here at the Nook on the campus of the University of Houston.
Yes, coffee and beer and campus.
That's right.
Your one-stop shop for everything you need. Pre-finals, this is a perfect place to be. It's a great place for us to come and interact with folks and talk about the most interesting thing I think that we could talk about, and that is American politics.
Right? That's right. And we are drinking coffee right now, but it would have been a beer, but I know Don would have been mad at us.
Right.
So we're gonna have to take a break on that. But we've got a lot to cover. We've got basically 100 episodes worth of stuff.
Wow.
Right? So what we want to try to do is make this as interactive as possible. Folks out there in the Nook, come on up and ask us a question. But let's kind of talk about sort of some of the big issues. And of course, El Presidente is
yes.
the number one. That's one of the reasons why this podcast has been so popular in large part is because people got really interested in politics after that 2016 election.
Yeah, it was a big shock, actually. So we were sort of texting each other about kind of what we thought the top issues were. And not surprisingly, the one thing on the top of both of our list was the election of Donald Trump. But we kind of took different sort of takes on exactly why we thought that was really interesting and important. I'll just go first. I mean, my sort of interest is in sort of how presidents handle their business unilaterally, right? We know that, of course, presidents have to share power and they have to work with Congress usually, but presidents have a lot of authority to be able to act on their own. So to me, the most interesting and impactful thing that President Trump has done is to kind of act on his own. That is not without controversy, right? Now, every president deals with this because you've got, obviously, a pushback from the public who may not like that they're not going through the regular process. And, of course, Congress who says, you know, you should be working with us to legislate instead of just sort of act like a king. But Donald Trump has gone really far on a lot of these things, Jay, right? I mean,
that's right.
We've got executive orders which are challenged consistently in court, right? The ban on certain countries and immigration from certain countries is one thing. He's talked about this last week, literally closing the U.S.-Mexico border. I think it's a bluff, but it's the kind of thing that is definitely, you know, worrisome for a lot of people who have to, you know, think about economics and what the trade sort of process will look like. So to me, that's a big sort of, you know, 1-2 punch. But the thing that we will remember Donald Trump for forever, I mean, forget the hair, forget the tan, right? Forget all of the crazy things he says. The thing that will be Donald Trump's legacy is the judiciary.
That's right. He's remade.
With speed.
Yeah. Has remade the federal judiciary. About 40% of all judges will be Donald Trump appointees. We are going to be dealing with it for a very, very long time. Two relatively young Supreme Court justices, a majority of the folks on appellate benches, and lots and lots of district court judges. The most interesting thing is he's bypassed even processes in the past that have had some semblance of bipartisanship. And so you've got an entirely different game here with him. On the executive orders, we've talked about this before. The irony, of course, was that he was very critical of President Obama in terms of issuing of executive orders, but he's been doing them willy-nilly. No president has put out more in a shorter period of time than Donald Trump.
It's like there's a tweet for everything, right? Everything Trump says or does, like there's always sort of a reaction, you know, from a tweet that he said that he shouldn't be done, right?
Right.
So there's so many of these that presidents change their mind. I mean, honestly, this is not uncommon for presidents, including Trump, right, to say, you get into the office and all of a sudden you stare down Pennsylvania Avenue, you think, all these fools in Congress, like, I can't get them to operate with me, right? I want to do this because I got a 4-year time window. I need to act quickly. So they change their mind quickly on how to act on their own.
Right, right. And I mean, I mean, we talked about sort of the governmental stuff, but for me, the Trump presidency is kind of defined by just this, the transformation on how, well, two things, how the president of the United States communicates with the general public.
Lots of yelling, right? Lots of caps.
And what
in the
standard of conduct is for the president of the United States.
Yeah.
So we've got two sort of fundamental differences, right? If Franklin Delano Roosevelt had radio and Reagan used television in a new sort of way, Donald Trump's been all about social media. It's all been about Twitter in particular, right? I mean, he is the Twitter in chief. We all remember Covfefe. Everyone
right.
Remember Covfefe?
I literally forgot about Covfefe, right? Where we debated like what that meant and why did he do it and, you know, is he drunk and like what's he thinking, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, but I mean, it's an interesting thing, right? Because we talk about the, I mean, it in previous elections, you've heard people talk about sort of the, you know, the office of the presidency, and it demeans the office of the presidency, and certain actions that someone does changes the way we view the presidency. That whole, all those standards have effectively been blown up, because what we have with President Trump is essentially a new standard on what goes, and in many ways, it is nothing more than kind of whatever you feel like doing, you're going to get to do.
Yeah. Do you remember when he had the sort of Twitter war with Rosie O'Donnell? And I thought, he'll never do that again, right? Clearly, he's learned his lesson, right?
He's had a Twitter war with a dead man,
yeah,
Brandon.
That's right. John McCain and Donald Trump are still fighting for some reason, right? To me, it's like if Teddy Roosevelt or if Andrew Jackson had Twitter, they would be like tweeting like dual requests at every person like that they could think of, because that's the kind of combativeness that we haven't seen in this country for like 200 years, right? I mean, this is really the kind of populist rage that's bubbled up into a presidency that's happened in the Jackson era, and it's happening now.
Well, I mean, you talk about sort of the populist rage kind of bubbling up. Sort of the other big reactive sort of pushback to the Trump presidency, really the Trump election, we forget that almost the day after he was inaugurated, we had the a National Women's March.
Yeah, that's right.
And that led to a massive reawakening of just lots of issues, you know, the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement. We saw, you know, Al Franken resign,
yeah,
and we saw scandals all the way that permeates to this day with what's going on with Joe Biden potentially.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's interesting. Do you see sort of a direct result of Trump?
Yeah.
Or is this just a natural evolution of kind of what you think would have happened otherwise?
You know, some of the reaction was to what was happening in Hollywood, right? So a lot of sort of Hollywood bigwigs ended up, you know, getting on the firing line because of the way they had handled their business. And that, I think, probably is sort of a long time coming. I think the Trump presidency sort of magnified that in a way that a lot of people said, this is, you know, something which needs to stop. So that, I think, contributed to it. But the politics, of course, have to sort of meet that kind of popular outcome. And it is now, right? One of the top picks that I had totally forgotten about was Roseanne Barr getting fired for the racist tweet that she sent, right? It's almost like now people feel sort of like they can say what they want, right? And yet there's this kind of restriction that limits that, right? So Joe Biden's a good example, right? Handsy Joe Biden.
Right.
We'll see what Trump's nickname for him will be. But like this, I think, will probably stem his ability to be able to get the consensus he needs to jump in the race. So I'm not sure he'll run strictly as a result of this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You raised something, Air, that we've had this weird sort of dynamic that's developed. You have people doing and saying more intolerable things than ever before. The rise of the alt-right, kind of extremist language in all variety of things, particularly on social media. At the same time, there's a level and a standard from social pressure that is changing the way people are, where people get fired over sort of moderate types of comments that would have been considered nothing in the past. But are very much now.
Like Amy Klobuchar, right? Mistreating her staff in Washington, this became a kind of big issue. I mean, I've literally have candidates throw phones at me. Like, this is sort of something that I guess you just like accepted, right? But more, right?
Yeah, there hasn't been a campaign where I haven't gotten the laundry of the person.
I can believe it. I can believe it, right? Yeah, you never had Mayor Brown, like, you know,
dress
you down in public, right? Jay, where's my cell phone?
He's dressed me down many a times. But I mean, you know, that aside, and, you know, the fact, sort of the weird little stuff like eating salad off of a comb.
off the comb?
Yeah, that's a little weird.
But this is off topic, like, why did she do that? I actually didn't see why.
Obvious answer. She did not have a fork, Brandon.
Because staff didn't bring it to her.
Yeah.
So it was like kind of a stab in the face to the staff.
Apparently so.
That's awful.
Apparently
okay.
so.
Well, okay. Yeah. Forks are better, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, again, this sort of larger issue to me of this question of, you know, you're seeing much more intolerant behavior, crazy language, crazy actions, the rise of extremism. At the same time, we're seeing people being held accountable in a way they haven't been before, which is a really positive thing. So we're
interesting dynamic so, to yeah. sort of, you know, this is the yin and yang of the Trump presidency, right? There's a sort of sense that now there's no rules, and yet there are still rules, right? Those restrictions are still in place.
And this was going on for a while, and then we got this massive clapback, which was, of course, the midterm elections, right? Yeah. So massive shift back. Now, I guess this is the first question. Did you see it as kind of a massive shift back, or did you see this just normally what happens in first midterm elections, the party out of power?
I think it's a little bit of both. I definitely think that it was a reaction to Trump. And I do think, though, that this is something which the party in power is going to suffer from. And so it's right. not surprising it happened. But how much it happened, I think, was pretty surprising. And the legacy of it and the continuation of it is really exciting and interesting, too. All right. Do you all have something that you think is the craziest thing that happened in the past 2 years or so? If you can even pick one, right? It's even hard to imagine.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm a huge fan, and I listened to your very first episode, so nice. It's really exciting to be here for the 100th episode. I'd like to hear more about what y'all think about Joe Biden and kind of the reaction that he's received. It seems like... you know, you're kind of more left folks. They're wanting to dismiss the level of interaction that he had with this woman, where, you know, who are we to say what makes somebody uncomfortable and what doesn't make somebody uncomfortable? So I think that, you know, you mentioned Senator Franken before, and we saw that with that too. Like, well, can't we just excuse some things? You know, why does it have to be everything with Me Too? So I'd like to hear maybe a little bit more thoughts on that.
Yeah. It's a great point. Yeah, I mean, if it weren't Joe Biden, then I think you'd be having a different conversation, right? That person would be, like, in a much worse shape, right? But because Biden has got a sort of stranglehold to some degree on the, like, some key Democrats, and the fact that he's still up in polling suggests that there are forces at work that are not just about those individual issues. In particular, a lot of the polling suggests Democrats care most about electability, and they think that Biden is the most electable for lots of reasons. I don't know exactly the eye roll that you gave. I totally concur with. I don't think that's true, but I think a lot of people sort of think that now because it's such a, like, new field in a way. So I think that'll change. But I do think that if it weren't Joe Biden, if it were, you know, if it were Cory Booker, it'd be a different story. And I think that's probably part of that dynamic.
I don't know. I think Joe Biden's spent the last 40 years being kind of the creepy uncle.
The pictures.
He's now evolved to becoming the creepy grandpa, right? That's kind of the vibe he's had. They've been inappropriate for pretty much the entirety of his career. So the question to me is kind of how do you process that, right? It's certainly not Me Too, but it's just really inappropriate. And he does it all the time. It's almost pathological, right? He can't help himself. So it's a little bit of an odd deal. Now, normally, you know, so there's sort of two ways to look at it. One is, we talked about this earlier in the context of Trump, that there is no standard anymore of how one behaves because the president has effectively sort of done away with that, right? The flip side is, we know it's that other, that sort of the other side I was talking about. There's greater sensitivity and understanding that inappropriate behavior won't be tolerated. And when you have 15 other options, people are less forgiving of the foibles of a particular candidate. And that's what you have on the Democratic side. You have 16, 17 choices. All that being said, Joe Biden has not ever been a particularly good presidential candidate. He's pretty much stunk up the joint the two previous times he ran. So this notion that he's some sort of juggernaut of a candidate, I think, has always been sort of fool's gold, you know, the ultimate sort of, you know, support that's a mile wide and an inch deep. People, he's likable, right? That he'd suddenly evolved to being likable, but he's not anybody with a strong base of support. I think it's arguable how much money he could even raise because he's in the past every time he's ever run. It's a whole lot easier when you're backup quarterback to Barack Obama for 8 years, right? Right, he's like, he had to, it's like for years, you know, Tom Brady's backup. It's the best job in right, football, right?
Right?
Right. That's effectively what he had.
Right.
So
the highlight was when he said it was a big effing deal, right?
Yeah,
when healthcare
that
got
was
passed,
literally
right?
that was like literally the high point of his vice presidency.
Right.
Right. So it wasn't like he was doing a bunch of heavy right. bunch of heavy lifting.
Yeah. And the problem for him too is that there's so many other options. I think that this is going to be like another problem for him. The only sort of flip to that is that all of these candidates have got problems, right? There's a lot of like, you know, issues with how they've voted in the past or issues with how they handle their staff currently. It's like, there's a lot of those problems. So everyone is sort of flawed in a different way. So it could be that it's a kind of pox on everybody's house and he emerges from this relatively unscathed. But the dynamics have changed. The metrics have changed. I mean, it's not just how much money you raise. It's how many people you raise the money from.
Right. Right?
It's the sort of social media push that you can get. Can Joe Biden at 155 years old get that? I don't know, right? That's a good question. Yeah.
On that same vein, we got a question from Jerry on Facebook. So
nice.
Who had a similar thing. Sort of how will these Democratic politicians, the 15, 16 or so, interact with each other? Do we think they're going to start?
You're being generous. It's more like 55 or
55,
so.
55,
right?
65, 100.
Right. By the end of the podcast, it'll be up to like.
Yeah, I mean, there's people. I tell people all the time, there are people running for president that I don't know. I literally don't know their names.
Right.
They're not exploratory, and they're actually in this thing.
They're all in it.
They're all in it. So how are they going to interact? So my take on it is you have to differentiate yourself. And so right now we're in this stage where everyone's differentiating themselves by saying, who can be the most progressive, right? So you've got just with one or two exceptions. So almost everyone is, we're talking about issues that we don't normally wouldn't expect to be talking about in 2019. Or 2020.
And candidates are begging for like literally a dollar, right? You probably all are getting these emails,
That's
right? It's like, give me $1, I want $1. And so I had a friend text me last night and he was like, why is Julian Castro asking me for $1?
That was the saddest.
What's he going to do with $1?
That was the saddest. Yeah.
And then you and I were texting last week about that. I told him, well, it's because you've got to get your 65,000 individual donors, and who doesn't matter how much money they're giving you as long as they're giving you money. So that's part of this new sort of field. The sort of statistics on this, the studies that have demonstrated that what happens when an incumbent unpopular president is challenged by a bunch of people, typically speaking, the more people in the field, the worse that party does. Partly because they're splitting the vote a bunch of ways. You know, end up with bad feelings. People are mad because their candidate didn't win. They don't work as hard to turn out their local communities for the Democrats. So that's a problem. And I think that that's probably likely to happen given how things are. And it's going to be a very close election. That could be the difference.
We got another question here from the audience.
Yeah, just had a quick question. Wanted to bring it back a little bit local to see if you guys could discuss the 2019 mayor's race, what you think is going to happen here and in the council races here in Houston.
We were just talking about the mayor's race like not too long ago. So, the incumbent mayor, Sylvester Turner, has two major challengers, significant challengers, Bill King, who ran last time and barely lost, and newcomer Tony Busby, who is a multimillionaire lawyer and self-funding. It's a really interesting race, right? Because we were talking about the concept of Busby's running a campaign entirely self-funded. He's pledged to spend kind of as much as he can. He's put in about almost $5 million already, and it will move the needle. I mean, it's almost impossible not to move the needle here. So the question then becomes what the impact will be. You know, I would suspect right now, particularly with the way the mayor is sort of dealing with the continued issues with the firefighters and the mayor himself barely won last time. And I think it's important to recognize that, that you'll probably see a runoff of some kind. So the question is kind of who gets into that runoff with Sylvester Turner, because barring something unusual, I think he will be in that runoff, whether it's Tony Busby or Bill King. I think, you know, I mean, I know it's easy for people to want to look at this as kind of a singular Democrat against two Republicans, and I will tell you that is not the way to look at this race. Tony Busby was a former chair of the Galveston County Democratic Party. He was also the single largest contributor to the Harris County Democratic Party in 2018. All those judges that got elected, in large part, can thank Tony Busby in some way. So there's a weird deal. Now, he also gave $500,000 to Donald Trump. So the guy's kind of all over the place.
And he was Rick Perry's attorney for some of the some of the indictments that he had a couple of years ago.
And Rick Perry named him to the A&M Board of Regents, and he hired John Sharp to be chancellor there. There's all sorts of weird little things. Bill King.
It's a thick web that we weave here from Houston, right?
Yeah, and so Sylvester Turner has hardly been this dynamic, progressive mayor, right? His signature achievement is pension reform.
Yeah.
Not exactly the sexiest progressive issue out there.
Can't wait
there,
to brag about that to my friends. Hey, what'd your mayor do? Well, mayor solved pension reform. Right?
which was Bill King's signature issue. So so the irony of it to me is that I think this race will be pretty close. You know, it's really, really hard to beat incumbents. So you would think that the mayor still has an advantage. In the era of term limits since 1991, an incumbent mayor has never lost. So you're really swimming against sort of the tide.
I think that's right.
Much in the same way that as much as Democrats really get excited about the prospect of beating Donald Trump, incumbents who don't get have significant primary challenges or third party never lose since 45. That's been the case. The only exceptions are at situations, Jimmy Carter in 1980. He had, of course, Ted Kennedy. And then John Anderson, and then George H.W. Bush had Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot.
Right.
Absent that, the incumbents say, so we could get four more years. Just think how many people will be listening to this podcast.
Probably
after a few more years of Donald
Trump.
70 million,
I guess, right? Easily. Yeah, I'm assuming that's right. I think you're right. I mean, I think that the mayor is in a bit of a bind. I mean, he's been governing from kind of center, also center-right, sometimes center-left, right? He hasn't been as progressive on some things, I think, as people would have hoped, right? Like, for instance, like affordable housing, although that's moving in a direction lately. The electorate has changed significantly since the last time he was up for election, so that it's much younger now, much more progressive than it was. That is going to change, I think, his calculations. It's going to, I think, limit the ability of any Republican to gain traction. I think that you're not going to see as much turnout, and it won't be quite the impetus as it was 4 years ago from King and from Busby, who I think are going to fight for the same votes. I mean, I know you mean they're both sort of semi-Republicans, right?
Yeah.
I mean, independents, probably. I mean, they're on both sides of some issues, or at least both sides of the scale, the spectrum. But, like, I do think that they're going to split the vote that's the protest vote against Turner, and that's the more kind of conservative vote. So how that plays out is really going to be pretty important. But if you're Tony Busby and you're going to spend $5 million, $10 million on this race, you can out conservative Bill King, right? And that's Bill King's problem at the moment. So we'll see how that plays out.
So we got another question from Facebook from Jerry. He's also asked about the Green New Deal, Brandon. What are our thoughts on the Green New Deal, and what do we think happens going forward?
We talked about this last week on the podcast. I made the point that the party may be moving in a more liberal direction, but it is not so much the case that we're going to see that, I think, resonating with Democrats currently, right? That's more like a 10-year window, right? So I think right now we can stick with our, like, handcrafted lattes here at the Nook, right? Which is going to be basically, you know, as sort of artisanal as we're going to see policy get.
I don't know. I mean, I've always thought that the concept of it is, you know, it's a moonshot, right?
It's an aspirational goal.
10 years is not reality. It's scientifically impossible to do it that way. But you're reaching for something. Now, the reality, of course, is, you know, being carbon neutral is a viable goal, but being like carbon free is really not. But that said, I think you'll probably see some increasing in this direction. The fact that we're having this conversation is a testament to it. Boy, Joaquin Castro was only one of two members of Congress in Texas to actually vote for the Green New Deal. John Cornyn will be letting everyone in Texas know.
He's not going to forget, right?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, this is especially, I mean, you're talking about, you know, this is a state that's been built on energy.
Right.
And there's a transitionary process to that. And the Green New Deal kind of cuts against that a bit. So we say all that, but we just had that ITC, you know, explosion and the toxic plume. Folks are unhappy. They want to see a whole lot more regulation. And so this might, you know, moving in this direction is probably something that could be popular.
We got one more question.
Yeah.
Oh, more questions. Yeah.
Celebrity questionnaire.
Longtime fan, first time questioner. I would love it if each of you could make a prediction. Who wins the Democratic primary? Who's our ticket? And bonus question, who's the VP?
Wow. All right. Okay.
Puffy taco?
Well,
it's just puffy taco.
We're going to have to bet something.
Our standard puffy taco.
Something. Puffy taco is always a good standard bet, right? El Real, great puffy tacos.
I'll tell you what I'll bet. Make it a carafe of mimosas at the Nook.
Oh, well, we return to the Nook for our
bet. Return
like
to the
idea.
Nook, and I am a mimosa fan.
All right.
I will get a carafe.
Okay,
of some
so whoever's
mimosas for you
closest.
And your lovely wife.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds good. That's a great, good bet.
All right.
Now, do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Oh, I want you to go first.
Right. Okay, let's see. Your president will be your nominee. And possibly president, probably I'm going to say president, will be Cory Booker. Your vice president will be Beto O'Rourke, circa 2017 October. That Beto O'Rourke. Not the past Beto O'Rourke, not the conservative O'Rourke, the more contemporary O'Rourke. Young ticket, you're balancing against geography. You've got a ticket that can win African Americans, that can win young people, that can win women. Historically, traditionally, that's been the case for both of those two. I'm thinking that's a pie in the sky bet. That's my guess.
I feel like you've already been drinking a carafe of mimosas, if that's what you came up with.
These are good.
All right, so yeah, you can tell. Apparently so. All right, straight off the top, Cory Booker is going to be dropped. I don't even know that he makes it to March 3rd.
He's going to catch fire. Have you seen the guy play football? He is a runner.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I think you're going to see
all
some
right,
action.
So I'm going to tell you that I think statistically the likelihood that the president or vice president from the Democratic side ticket will be a woman is almost a near certainty.
You think so?
Okay. I think so. So I think just based on the nature of the party. I think we've talked about this before. I think it's almost impossible to win the Democratic primary without doing extremely well in the South. You cannot do well in Democratic primary in the South unless you can win significant numbers of African-American voters. I'm going to tell you right now, the Democratic nominee for president will be Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Kamala Harris, okay. I believe that.
And I'll agree with you that the vice president will be none other than Beto O'Rourke.
I think that's right, but like liberal Beto O'Rourke, not conservative Beto O'Rourke, right? Because they're sort of two versions of the same, right? I think that's probably close. The other option I was thinking was maybe Julian Castro, right? Who I think can sort of
and
magnify
just,
Latino vote.
You are just scraping the bottom on both these guys. I love Julian Castro, but he's begging for a dollar, man.
Right.
He's literally begging for a dollar.
We've all been there, though, right?
He doesn't have 65,000 contributors.
Right.
You're talking about O'Rourke and Sanders and Harris. Harris got dead 65,000 in the first weekend.
Well, look, here's why Castro's a good pick. He's a good pick because it puts Texas in play. It puts potentially the rest of the Southwest in play. If a Democratic nominee can win those areas, then it makes the rest of the path much cleaner, and you don't have to worry so much about like what's happening in Wisconsin.
No, I agree. I think now that's the ticket that I think will happen. The strongest ticket, and I'm not trying to be a homer here, is O'Rourke running for president and Harris being vice president. And the reason being, if you can win Texas, we do not have a presidential race.
Right.
And the only Democrat that can make Texas competitive in 2020 is Beto O'Rourke. It's not Julian Castro.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, I think there's a chance he could. I mean, I think that he can activate the Latino vote. That hasn't been fully committed to Democrats. I think this would probably put them more solidly into the 70% range. And so that would be, I think, a game changer. But I do think the O'Rourke probably at this point has got a better sort of trajectory. But he had a lot of crowds in Austin. He went to Houston. He was in El Paso, right? So Texas definitely loves some Beto, right?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, we were talking about this exact issue, right? The other big sort of shift in gears in Texas has been, during the midterms, has been sort of Beto-mania and the return of the Texas Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Or Texas Democrats in general. I mean, it's not to say the party. No one saw that coming. I think you and I were predicting, there was a real fundamental question, how competitive he could even be against Ted Cruz. And our good friend, I'll pick on him because he's not here, Mark Jones, was just saying he's not going to raise any money because he's not taking PAC money.
Right.
It's impossible
Where's
to run.
Where's the money going to come from?
There's no way he can raise enough money. And now, he's basically his fundraiser base, not unlike Bernie Sanders. It's like an ATM machine,
right?
All those hundreds of thousands of individual contributions that he gets.
Yeah.
You know, $5, $10, $25 has just sort of transformed the place. And Texas Democrats by and large. So the big question to me is just whether or not how that did. Oh, wait, we've got another questionnaire.
All right.
And she's wearing a Beto shirt.
Hello. Perfect timing for me. Hello, everybody. So on the topic of Beto O'Rourke being your prediction for vice president for the upcoming 2020 election, me and my family were avid supporters of Beto, but we're kind of iffy about him. We don't think he's very experienced, but we do know that he's one for working across party lines. Do you think he's the right person, the right candidate to work across these like polarizing lines and...
No, I think he's not, in part because that is a hard sell at this point, right? I mean, getting the parties to agree is a really tall order. What we have basically is sort of, we have this sort of party government where we lurch between one majority to the other majority. So it's difficult to get any one party to sort of reach across the aisle because politically it doesn't make sense for them to do that. So I'm going to have to say no, not because Beto can't do it, but because nobody can do it. I mean, there are so few.
That is fair. Yes.
I'll say this. I think the only caveat to that is you can get bipartisanship depending on how you win. So you have to win, and it's where you win. So one of the arguments for why O'Rourke would be interesting is that he's going to, for the viability of him running for president will be his ability to win in places like Texas, Arizona, Colorado, sort of a new map, right? And by doing so, he would get a lot more support. I think that might be the transformative thing as opposed to winning 17 states. He's trying to win more, trying to win in different areas. You get bipartisanship in many ways by sort of dominating the field. And that's kind of, I think, how you would do it. That's certainly how it worked for, you know, folks like Reagan when he had sort of that. He forced bipartisanship because you were afraid they were popular. They were popular in red places, and that's really how to do it. So I kind of disagree with you on this because I do think he's the candidate who can do well in those places. Yeah. Everyone else, I think, largely is going to try to run a traditional map.
Yeah, I have a paper on this in case you're interested.
Yes, he does.
I am interested, presidents
now have difficulty building bipartisan consensus because the parties are trying to carve off their own wins, and so there's no political incentive to cross over. And presidents, instead of trying to prime up their own popularity in a state, are more likely to try to rally support of their own partisans and then make sure they get their numbers solid, right? So instead of the goal being, I'm going to get some crossover people to come support me, it's, I want to make sure my team is in place and doing well. So that's a different sort of dynamic to how modern presidents are handling it. So that's a challenge. It's basically, then you need to be like the best Republican and best Democrat you can be. And that's partly why I think you have that. But who knows, maybe O'Rourke will win some of these states, right? I mean, the rhetoric is inspirational. It's lofty. I like it. You know, he has been in Oklahoma and Nevada, right, on his, like, you know, tour, his kind of solo solace tour, right? Yeah. So who knows? Maybe he'll pick up
those things. And I don't think it's ideological as much as just winning. And so the more you win, the better chance. I think we've got one more question from the audience here. All right, this is great.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your question.
Hi, my name is Cameron, and I have a question about potential candidates that could be running. So I think that kind of brings into mind a certain individual. I wouldn't name.
Is it a nameless individual?
Just for the comic effect. But the second part of my question has to do with what the dynamics would be if someone that's at the top of the polls were to enter this race.
Oh, are you talking about Joe Biden, if Joe Biden got in the race? Okay.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that. I think that Biden will clearly have a pretty, like, serious operation. He's got the money, he's got the organization, but he's got some liabilities. So we'll see, like, how that all plays out. I think if his initial thrust is not big, if the fundraising moment is not massive the way it has been for, like, for Harris or for O'Rourke, then I think you're going to see kind of his ceiling, and that'll be our signal that, like, he's not going to go farther, right? Yeah.
Well, didn't all that money come in after they announced?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like
right. So how would Biden know if that money's going to come in?
Yeah. So the issue with Biden has always been that the new dynamic are small individual contributors, and so the issue in the past has been he's not been a prolific fundraiser. In the two previous times he's run, he was.
But that was before he was vice president.
Correct. Correct. Now the other thing to remember is that campaign, most of the people associated in the 08 and 12 campaigns are now belong to someone else. They've sort of evenly split in different places. O'Rourke's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley is an Obama person. David Plouffe, I think, is doing some consulting for O'Rourke as well. You've got different people doing different things for different campaigns. So the staff that he has is different. We just don't know. And I think the issue is the best predictor of future performance oftentimes is what you've done in the past. And Joe Biden has not been a great candidate himself. Now he's been a great and loyal vice president, but we have to see how he does as a presidential candidate. I'm a little bit dubious about how well he'll actually do.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, this should be interesting if he gets in the race, because he's the 800-pound gorilla, right? Like, that would change the dynamics of it. So from a lot of people scrapping to get their dollars, right, we'd have Joe Biden, who's like, you know, all of a sudden sets the agenda. So
right.
I think it'd change a lot if he got it.
Yeah, and he doesn't need as much money because he's so much better known. He's the only guy running with 100% name ID. Everyone knows who he is. He's wildly popular by most accounts. Yeah. He's probably a lot of people's second or first choice. And so
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's all right.
Keep my thought in place. Some people would argue that he's potentially the establishment candidate. So if he were to announce, everybody would fall in line behind him and he wouldn't have a funding problem.
You might see some of that, or you might see, and you also see some pushback, right? Two people saying, you know, it's time for kind of a younger generation. So I think you're going to see, reactions in both ways. Now, do you think that, speaking of the 1980s, do you think you're going to find a reaction, a challenge to Trump on the Republican side?
Well, we got Bill Weld running, and he, of course, is the one challenger. John Kasich is still out there.
Flirting with it, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So you might get someone. Hey, I think we've got another question here.
Yeah.
Great. From a fellow academic.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Sure, yeah. So you mentioned at the top that one of the president's major impacts was his change to the courts and the conservative leaning of the courts. And with the Green New Deal that you talked about and other more left-leaning policies, there's an argument that without a plan to deal with the courts, there's no real point to these policy proposals. So with that said, what's your thoughts on the Pack the Courts movement that has been developing on the Democratic side of the campaign, and whether or not any candidates more than the one should embrace it?
Yeah, I'll say this. It didn't work out that well for FDR. Right? I think that the dynamics of that are like really dicey. People traditionally are not that comfortable making those kinds of big changes. So I just don't know that that's the way to go, right? Of course, the spirit is that they're desperate, right, to sort of stop that process because, like Jay said, I mean, the numbers are outstanding. You're going to see the federal courts being totally remade as a result, and maybe even the Supreme Court if things go that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. I think in a perfect world, if you're sort of redoing it, instituting some sort of term limits or some sort of reform, I think would be a positive thing. I think there's some increasing opinion on that, but part of it is sort of the mechanism by which you would do it, right? Would it be congressional action? Would it require a constitutional amendment? Because whatever you do, ironically, you're going to deal with the separation of power issue because you're going to get it's going to get challenged
in the
courts itself. And so it's going to create sort of this odd dynamic, I think. But I agree with it. I just think I'm not quite sure how you get there. Because our politics is so divided and so stark right now. But it's certainly, I think, something that needs to be done. It's not that dissimilar from the issues around the Electoral College and why people want to get rid of the Electoral College and the mechanisms by which to do that.
Yeah. The process to get there is going to be really complicated. So, yeah, that's the restriction, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Can I push back on the FDR point?
Yeah.
So you said that it didn't work out for FDR, but it actually caused the Supreme Court to back down.
That's true.
So even if it's not successful, just the policy point.
But in an extrajudicial way, right, which I'm not comfortable with, right? We have these processes in place, and if we don't respect the process and we use this sort of institutional leverage as part of the political scene, it makes me uncomfortable to have it process that way. So regardless of how we feel about like the actual, you know, legislation up for discussion. So I guess that's my worry that would happen that way. Yeah.
We've got one more question.
All right. Awesome.
So my question might be a little silly. We're at the Nook near the beautiful University of Houston campus. What do you think about Elizabeth Warren not mentioning the university by name or calling UH Community College, and like whether this like helps or hurts her?
And I know. Right?
I will say this because I really do like Elizabeth Warren a ton, and I think she has like more ideas and more detailed policy than anyone.
Right.
I do, for the life of me, do not understand it. I recognize the fact that she graduated here a long time ago, and in her mind, the University of Houston looks like one thing. Mm-hmm. But as we all know, this university has transformed itself in the last two decades, really in the last 10 years under the leadership of the current chancellor, and has done a magnificent job. This is a beautiful campus. It is not the commuter school, I believe, as she likes to refer to it. It's one of the top universities in the state and in the country now, and just finished up in the round of the Sweet 16.
That's right. Kind of a heartbreaking loss.
So with that, I don't understand why she does that. I think it's sort of, she's got a great story to tell.
Right.
Coming from very little, worked her way through. We hear a lot about the biographies of a lot of the candidates, but Elizabeth Warren chooses not to acknowledge that she should be a proud UH Cougar.
Right. I totally agree, right? Once you're a Cougar for life. So do not walk away from
it. You kind of want her to just say, whose house, Warren's house? But she won't
right.
do it.
Whose house, right? Yeah.
That's right.
So I think that we'll hopefully have that remedied. We talk so much about Texas being in play and the importance of it being like in the center of the Democrat strategy to, you know, kind of, you know, troll Republicans. Why not talk more about it, right? She's got a natural fit, unlike, say, other people who don't. I think she should. I think she will.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is normally recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Theater at Houston Public Media, but we are at The Nook on the campus of the University of Houston.
Absolutely. Hey, big thanks to Houston Public Media for putting this on and for dealing with us for 100 episodes. Thanks to John DeRacy, our executive producer, Sophie Mall, our producer day-to-day, the hardest working producer in podcasts. Thank you all for listening, and we hope to have another 100 episodes, and next time we'll be back here, right?
That's right.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes, providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.